For the latest London Undone podcast, I visited an unusual National Trust property in southwest London, which from the outside is ordinary to say the least. 575 Wandsworth Road is not a stately home, but it is now a national treasure. To find out more, I spoke to Rachel Pearson, who's one of the volunteer house guides here.
All our visitors come through the front door and they are amazed, and most people say wow, or they gasp, or they say I can't believe it. They are just awestruck, they really are. And they want to know more almost from the first step in.
What would you see from the outside?
You see a normal looking late Georgian terraced house. It doesn't look particularly special. It's on a very busy main road and it sits opposite a council estate. There's really nothing to tell you what's lying waiting to be discovered. The front door from the outside is what looks like a piece of board up with a letterbox in it. It looks nothing. So the most important thing to bear in mind is that this was the home of Hadambi Asalachi from 1981 until his death in 2006. And Mr. Asalachi created everything you see here in the house today. In fact, we had a really nice compliment paid by somebody who knew him during his lifetime, who said that were he to walk back in through the front door today, he could pick up his life where he left off, which is really sweet. We are thinking about this much more as a home than as a museum.
As we've heard by the description of its exterior, this is clearly not the home of a wealthy prince, duke or earl. It's the home of Mr. Asalachi. Who was this man and what was he doing here?
Mr. Asalachi acquired 575 Wandsworth Road primarily because it was close to his place of work, which was in Westminster. He was a civil servant by day in the Treasury and then in the Cabinet. However, that masks the background in arts that he had. So Mr. Asalachi was a Kenyan gentleman. He was born in Kenya and he studied architecture at the University of Nairobi. He won a scholarship to go and further his studies at the University of Rome. And whilst in Rome, he decided to diversify slightly and he went to Vienna and Geneva to study fine art. And we think he came to London probably in the 1960s. And in the 1960s, he diversifies again. He studies for an MPhil in the philosophy of mathematics, for which he got a distinction, as you do. And he also pursued a literary career. His best known works are called A Calabash of Life, which is a novel, and there's a collection of poetry called Sunset in Naivasha. Both are out of print, but copies are available at the School of Oriental and African Studies in their library there.
I happily have a signed copy of Sunset in Naivasha, and I happen also to have stayed on the shores of Lake Naivasha in Kenya. Here is a short poem from this collection. It's called A Poet. A fresh breeze from a distant land blew through his pen.
By the time he bought 575 Wandsworth Road, he was pursuing his artistic talents as more of a hobby than as anything fundamental to his day job. So the reason Mr. Asalachi saw that 575 Wandsworth Road was for sale is because he was on the bus, which goes right past the front door here, going to work one day, and he thought to himself, that looks like a nice house and it's a bit closer to the office, I'll go and have a look. When he came inside, Mr. Asalachi decided that this was the house for him for three main reasons. Firstly, he loved the fact that because this was built in about 1819, no one had messed around with the layout too much. We start down here on the lower ground floor, which is where you have a dining room and a small kitchen. You do now have an internal bathroom, which of course wouldn't have been there originally. Upstairs, so on the sort of raised ground floor, you have a through living room. And then on the top floor, you have a master bedroom and a second smaller bedroom come study. And he was delighted that the second bedroom hadn't been lost by creating a bathroom up there. Second reason is that there's a bright, sunny, enclosed garden at the back, and he was a very keen gardener, and this is one of the projects that the National Trust is working on at the moment, to restore the garden to how it was when Mr. Asolacci lived here. And thirdly, Mr. Asolacci was very, very taken with the play of light through this house, and what he's done is try to enhance that in various different ways. He moves in 1981, and the house essentially is structurally sound, but it was previously lived in by a group of people that he termed dossers. Bit impolitically correct these days, but what is absolutely certain is that these people had a menagerie of animals that they kept in the back garden, and they would walk and take through the front door and into the park beyond for exercise. And that meant that the house was in a really poor decorative state, because apparently the menagerie of animals included a pig and a small horse. You know, maybe they were trying to emulate the good life.
You're not going to bring those. Like the National that. Trust isn't going to bring those back into
the garden. Yeah, not into the garden. This is pre-Mr. Asolacci. So he sets about decorating, as you would do. And he's decorating away, and he realises he has a problem with damp on the west wall of the property. And that's because at the time, in the 1980s, there was a commercial laundrette immediately next door. Remember I said this is a terraced house. Any water that leaked out of the machines from the laundrette went straight through a poured concrete floor and had nowhere else to go but rise up the west wall of his property. Mr. Asolacci calls in plumbers, builders. Nobody can sort it out. And one day, and this is 1985 by this point, he's lived with the damp problem for 4 years. He's out walking and he sees in a skip some floorboards. And he thinks to himself, I know what I'm going to do. I'm going to bring those home. I'm going to fix them to the wall, cover up the damp, and forget about it. He adopted what he termed a head in the sand approach to the problem. And that's what he did. And the floorboards that you see on the wall there, the vertical planks, are the ones that Mr. Asolacci, he used battens to attach them with. And you can actually see where the damp, where the water has come through the cracks in the floorboards or the joins in the floorboards.
Is there still a damp problem?
The National Trust, when they took this property over, believe it or not, stripped that wall of all its contents. All the plates, all the fretwork were moved off the wall temporarily, and a plastic membrane was put in behind the floorboards. So the floorboards came off as well.
Right.
And so the wall is about less than half a centimetre thicker than it was before.
Right.
That's the best they could do. It may need doing again in the future, but there was nothing else to be done. And Mr. Asolacci is a really artistic gentleman, and he thinks to himself, these look really flat and really uninspiring. I do not like how this is finished in my house. This isn't finished. So he decides he'll decorate the floorboards. And the first ever bit of fretwork that Mr. Asolacci created were the arrowheads that you'll see underneath those metal skewers, that little row of pointed spades.
Or clubs,
yeah,
one or the other.
That's a better way of putting it, yeah. Yeah, whichever the suit of cards is. That little row was the first row that he created. And he loved how that looked. He was really happy with that. So he decided he would decorate the rest of the wall in a similar style. Then he decided he would decorate the rest of this room similarly, and then he decorated the rest of the house. And that's putting it in a very trite way. But we do know that Mr. Asolacci was extremely methodical as he worked. And the order in which you're going to see the rooms in the house is the order in which he did the work. And every time he would set about decorating a room with this wooden fretwork, he would sit, he would contemplate what he wanted to do. If he made preparatory sketches, they certainly don't survive him. And once he'd decided what he wanted to do, he would draw the patterns onto a piece of wood. He would take a little pad saw blade and he would hand carve the patterns that he'd drawn out onto the wood. a very laborious process. It's no wonder it took 20 years for him to finish it. He started in 1985 and he declared that this was a finished work in 2005, just a year before he died.
So people were walking past this, driving past, on the bus going past, all the while he's
never
busy
knowing.
Creating this.
I tell you, the reason, one of the reasons I volunteer here is because I went to primary school just across the way. So I'd have walked past this house every day whilst he was here and had no clue.
So yeah. he was carving here when you were coming to school.
Yeah.
He started that when you went to...
Yeah, when I... Almost exactly when I went to primary school, yeah. That's the other thing. I think this house is so timeless. I think if you come and visit this one in 50 years' time, you won't be able to place it as to when it was done and when it was created.
I think that's because it's so personal, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's not of the 80s or 90s, or it's just its own little place.
That's a really good observation, because the influences that he used. He talked about his influences in a lecture that he gave in 1996. So by this point, he's been doing the work for just over 10 years, and as it turns out, just over half the time it would take to complete it. He gave a lecture to a group of architecture students, and he cited three sources of inspiration. He first mentioned the houses that you'll find just off the Kenyan coast on the island of Lamu. These houses are made predominantly, apparently, of coral, unusual building material, and perhaps not one that we should be trying to use for building. And within the houses are niches where women keep imported Chinese porcelain pots. And the porcelain pots are supposed to capture evil spirits that may be haunting your house, which I think is quite charming.
Yes.
Mr. Asolachi, apparently he said he hadn't actually visited Lamu, but he must have heard stories about this when he was a child and he'd been influenced. And again, if you look in this room, we're still in the dining room, the niches up there, those are the niches that he's created where he keeps not pots, but some of his porcelain collection. He also cites Moorish architecture, particularly the Alhambra Palace and the mosque at Cordoba. These buildings seem to have lovely lattice work in the stonework. And again, if you look at the kind of trellising work that he's done, you can see references to that in his fretwork. Amazing to think, this is the first room he carved. I know this looks a bit rustic, but he did it all by hand.
You can tell it's done by hand. You can also see, you said he drew onto the wood and you can see the pencil marks in some cases.
Exactly.
But that's
part
lovely,
of its charm.
Yeah.
And then thirdly, he also mentions the Yali houses that you'll find on the shores of the Bosphorus, which are the big wooden houses from the 19th century. It's there, they have quite grand window frames and doorways and porches and things like that. And some of the shapes you can find replicated in his work. So it's interesting that you observe that it's a very personal house, because certainly those are quite an eclectic range. And you can tell it's from someone who's well-travelled and well-versed in various different art forms from around the world.
Yeah, and cultures. You've mentioned that this is fretwork. Could you, to a listener, describe what fretwork is?
Fretwork is essentially, it's taking usually a fairly thin piece of wood and carving patterns into it, I suppose, and then using that to stick on walls or ceilings as decoration.
How did he, was it glue, was it nails? How did he stick everything?
A combination. Some is glue, some is, so it's pins and glue in the main, and there will be parts where you can see the pins sticking out even still, because possibly he was using them just to fix it and make sure that the glue had dried, and maybe he meant to remove them, I don't know.
So seem pretty simple materials that any of us could do at home.
Yes.
But having said that, do things fall off? Does it all stay put?
It does.
Quite often fall off.
Sometimes he's carved extremely thick pieces of wood. There's a row of figures in this room which look perhaps like a nomadic tribe with their cattle in the middle. And if you look at it side on, you'll see the thickness of the wood. So how he managed to create those figures, some of which are joined together, I have no idea. He must have had a lot of patience. With all these sources of inspiration, Mr. Asolacci felt that in each case they kind of are quite flat and they have quite sharp edges to them. And he didn't want his work to be very dense and heavy. He wanted it to have a certain lightness and vitality to it. And in order to achieve that, he's used, again, various different techniques as he's gone along. One of the easiest to spot is the fact that you'll see parts of the house where you think, oh, I think that's unfinished. It looks as though there's something missing. Or you think something's fallen off the wall. And it's just a deliberate, almost a pause in the work. In this room, again, if you look up at the ceiling, you see that the fretwork are in that corner, yeah, and on that corner come in towards the room.
Yeah.
Whereas there's a line, you might not be able to see it with shadows.
Okay.
There's a line that goes across where he must at one point have been contemplating putting some work on the ceiling there. And then he thought, no, actually, I'm going to leave it as a little pause. And it just gives you a chance to go, breathe, and then carry on looking at the rest of it.
And there's no, as you've got me to look at it, that fretwork that he's put on the ceiling and around the edges, it's not uniform all the way around.
This is another technique that he used. He said that in nature, there's no such thing as perfect symmetry, but there's always balance and harmony. And so everything you see is balanced and harmonious and has a charm of its own, but nothing is entirely symmetrical. And the other thing is that he does try and soften corners where he can.
It's a feast for the eyes. And then as I'm looking, I'm just seeing so many things pop out. And as you were saying earlier, you've worked here for a year and all the time you suddenly see something you've not seen before.
Every time I come in, there's something new. It's amazing, isn't it? Because you think, after a while, you think, oh, well, I'm bound to have seen everything at least once.
Whether you really look at the details or you simply enjoy the overall atmosphere of the house, it's incredible to think this was the labour of one person working in his spare time.
The work takes, as I've said, 20 years. He carves a lot of it outside. In fact, the majority is carved outside the back door on the bridge over the crocodile pit, is what he called it. It's the walkway over the light well, if you want to be more humdrum about it. And he would sit there whittling away. He could carve, he was quite happy to carve for 12 to 14 hours at a stretch if he had the opportunity to do so, for maybe 4 or 5 days at a time as well. He doesn't have never had a television, so it shows you what can be done if you don't have a television. And we just get the feeling that this was his way of relaxing and enjoying himself. It's not just a hobby and it's not just DIY. It's much more than that. It becomes almost an immersive experience for him. It must have done. The material that he uses is mostly season pine, and mostly he found the wood in skips, and the season pine worked well because it didn't warp with the damp in the same way that other woods would, and also it was soft enough to carve by hand. When he was going around looking for the wood in the skips, he'd sometimes find fragments of furniture that he thought, I can use that, I can bring that home and include it in this decoration that I'm doing. Which other home do you know where you could stick a frontispiece of a wardrobe onto a wall and make it look good? Certainly not mine.
I mean, the walls are decorated, the ceiling has got decoration on them, and the furniture as well he's decorated. There's a piano stool behind us which has got carvings. He's put carvings onto that. I noticed the sort of kitchen side table.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, nothing has escaped
his attention. So if he feels he can add to a ready-made piece, he will. If he feels it's complete as it is, then he leaves it, like the radio, which is sat on a very nice stand that he's obviously made, but the radio itself has escaped any decoration on its sides or its top.
And also, because of the wood, the pine that you, the material that you said he used, it's got that kind of ski chalet feel to it, to a certain extent as well.
Or a sauna.
Sort of a sauna, a cosy little Swiss chalet.
There's an arga, a gas-powered arga in the kitchen. So when he lived here, it must have been really cosy, I think, at this time of year. The radiators would have been on. There is central heating. The fires would have been going in the living room. The candelabra would have been lit, and it would have felt quite snug little
and
house.
And how brave of him to light any fire in
this He obviously didn't worry.
Well, whatever it makes you feel, the decorated carved wood that fills this entire house is unusual, and it's wonderful to find it preserved and kept for us all to enjoy today. How did it come into the hands of the National Trust, I wondered?
Essentially, friends of his saw what he was doing and said to him, you need to think about what's going to happen to this house in the future. You can't just leave it and, you know, eventually you will either move or you'll pass away. And he was persuaded to leave it as a gift in his will to the National Trust. It didn't come with an endowment, so the National Trust had to decide that it was worth fundraising for, and they had to fundraise in order to have enough money to keep this property going. But because of its uniqueness, they decided it was worthwhile. Because Mr. Attalachi was, by all accounts, a very modest, humble, quite enigmatic man, the information that we have about him and his work is quite limited, as a mark of respect to him as a person. So we enjoy this as a home that's highly decorated.
People coming here hopefully are inspired to just do things yourself and to create and make and forge your own happy little home.
I'd like to think people go away with a slightly different idea of how their interiors could look, other than putting wallpaper or paint onto a wall. It doesn't all have to be like that. I doubt we have many visitors who go away and start hand carving wood, bits of wooden fretwork and stick it to their walls, but hey, maybe they do.
Shall we have a look at other features in the
house? So we're going to go up and look at the living room next, because as I say, we see it in the order that he did the work in. So we leave the kitchen and the bathroom until last, because those were the two rooms he did.
Yeah, I can take my shoes off.
All the visitors are asked to take their shoes off. So immediately you can see why we ask visitors to put socks on, or take their shoes off, I should say, because the floors are decorated. They're painted with linoleum paint. I didn't even know that was a thing. But Mr. Attalachi would mix the colours himself. And his mantra was that in most houses, floors are neglected areas. And he didn't want that to be the case here. So as you can see, he's put two, they're called kilim rugs, down on the floor. Mm-hmm. And he's then just extended the patterns from the rugs in by using the paint around the rug area, I suppose.
Yes. In the distance, there are sort of little tables and chairs that almost look like Chinese ivory carved.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? They're so delicate.
That was deliberately carved to house his prized possession of inkwells. That's what the glass objects are on the top of that table, and deliberately placed against the window where during the day the light comes through and reflects and refracts off the inkwells. And the copper jugs at the back, equally, they have some reflection and catch the light in different ways.
Yeah.
This is the room that you can see where he's really gone to town and really played around with the concept of light and shadow.
And I'm just looking up and I can see he's painted some of the door as well.
Yes, so he does this room second, and for some reason he suddenly introduces the idea of paint as a concept into the work, even though predominantly it's still fretwork. He paints the outside of the living room door, which means that Mr. Attalachi must have intended for this door never to be closed. In my house, that would not happen, because I'd want to keep the heat in a room like this. but he presumably always had it open so that all he could see was the front of it, or the other side of it.
Amazing.
But what's really cool is that he's used the knot of the wood in the door to act as a pond, and then he's painted a duck and a heron and some little pond flowers onto the knot. So just using what the wood gives him rather than creating everything from scratch.
Wow, lovely.
So it is, there's a lot of introduction of colour in this room.
I've noticed in the next to the front window, there's a sort of panel to the left. He's carved a wooden frame, and there's nothing in the sort of area where there could be a picture or something, but there is a painted shadow which almost looks like it's a continuation of the wood.
You're so observant.
It's so extraordinary.
So if you'd asked me what my favourite part of this room is, that's my favourite part, that panel that you've just been describing. What Miss Traslott, she starts to do a lot more, there is some examples of it in the dining room, but a lot more in this room, is he uses the fretwork in a kind of layering technique. So he sticks a bit to the wall and he sticks a bit in front of that and then a bit more in front, again, to play with this, maybe not shadow so much as this depth and perspective. Mm. And in that panel, he's then used the paint, as you said, to draw it down to a shadow. And when the sun's shining, it's quite effective. And at this time of night, usually that standing lamp is lit and there are crystals inside that lampshade, which is a lampshade that Mr. Asalachi has carved out himself, possibly trying to emanate the pierced lampshades from Morocco and Turkey. And so this effect is just, it's made more of. And when he lived here, as I say, we never light the candelabra for fear of losing this whole unique property. But you see all the candles. There's one candelabra there. There's another on the side table, plus the little carryable candle. There are candles on the mantelpiece. There are candelabras down at this end of the living room as well.
Everywhere.
And it just would have been this amazing kind of flickering, ever-changing atmosphere in the room.
Wow, and there are books here. So these are his books as well.
His books, his CDs.
His collection of books, his CDs.
His
even.
Coal scuttle. I mean, don't you have one of those in your house?
No.
No, funnily enough. But again, I'm presuming that's a reference to the fact it was a working fireplace. So, and what I love is that Mr. Asalachi, he's clearly a big collector. But he presumably collects things that he likes, not because they're intrinsically valuable. He doesn't want to sell these objects at any point.
Yeah.
And so he's got these Coptic crosses. I don't know how much these would be worth, but these are genuine. And then in pride of place above them, above the mantelpiece, is this tongue-in-cheek picture of two Egyptians on the telephone. Which I just think is... That just says a lot about his humour, about him as a man, that, yeah, I'm going to put a picture that's clearly not authentic or genuine in any way just up as a little joke.
I love this. My favourite thing in this room is in the back part of the sitting room, around the central light fitting, he's created a sort of path, circular path, of almost like they're stars that are just letting go of that central...
And do you see there's even one of the outside... figures as an angel playing a trumpet.
There's an angel that's sort of falling away from it. Wonderful.
Yeah.
Personally, what's your favourite part of it?
Oh, what do I like? People often say, well, is there a story in the figures, or what do all these masks mean?
Mm.
And there isn't. And I think whatever narrative he had in his head, it must have been a private internal dialogue almost, that we can just sit and appreciate because we know it was finished, but we don't have any further understanding of it. So we can just apply our own stories or our own ideas onto what we see in front of us. This is the master bedroom. This is where Mr. Asalachi slept. What you'll see in here is an even greater use of colour and paint, and a lot of the paintwork that you see, people often ask if it's stenciled. but it's not. He drew every single item freehand. And what I like, again, there's just this lovely sense of space, which is quite incredible. I mean, look at the ceiling is super decorated, and obviously the walls are as well, and yet you have this huge space in the middle where he's just left it blank. He's left that pause. You can breathe. You can say, yep, that's okay. I'm not being overwhelmed. I've got enough to look at.
Despite being packed with things to look at and many, many details, there are indeed many spaces and areas in which you can just breathe. Finally, Rachel showed me the second bedroom at the top of the house.
So this is probably the most highly painted room, and especially the ceiling is one of the most painted. I would never say there's a progression to Mr. Asolucci's work, and yet there is development. He obviously experiments and explores different ideas, and in here he's gone for this brightly coloured, thick application of paint. And even then, he's not necessarily seen it all the way through. He's kind of painted bits and then stopped or changed colour or not finished it, if you want to say not finished it in inverted commas. Mr. Asolucci doesn't believe in photos, and you'll see there are no photos throughout the house. And therefore, when he travelled, if he wanted to record it, he would paint it rather than take photos. So the panel we're looking at the moment is the course of the River Nile. Whereas this was a trip he did to Zanzibar. And in this panel, you have charcoal eating monkeys on the left-hand side, which apparently are native to Zanzibar, or this particular part of Zanzibar he traveled in. So he'd seen those. There are girls in their white communion dresses, and a painting of a dhow he would have seen them making them.
I love gold, and there are bits of goldy paint that he's added here as well and in the picture.
Yep.
Hints of it. Wonderful.
And again, that's to catch the light.
Yeah, everything.
So everything's always considered in terms of where it will best enhance the play of light and shadow in the room. So that gold is for that reason. And then you get a little safari scape over the top there, with a rhinoceros and some antelope, maybe, giraffes, and a couple of elephants. And then the very British red and grey squirrel in the middle round.
Extraordinary.
And then he came out and did the staircase and the hallway. I think this is my favourite. I don't know. I have a lot of favourites, but I love this bit of
the hallway. Even the light switches are framed. Well, this one is anyway.
Yeah, but notice that the light switches in most cases are very dirty. He obviously, cleaning wasn't high on the agenda because we've left it exactly as he had it.
Yeah.
So they haven't got dirty in the last 10 years.
Oh, should we go back there?
We better, hadn't we? You never know what's going on behind closed doors.
Yeah.
You really don't.
And
never judge a book by its cover, although perhaps he was rather unusual looking. I don't suppose every civil servant wore a cravat to work in the 1980s.
It is hard to judge anything by its cover. The exterior of the house betrays the magnificence of its interior. The humble civil servant working in the treasury is actually a master craftsman and artist. And as Rachel said earlier, we know very little about Kadambi Asolucci. But simplistically put, I think one of his poems reveals a little bit more about him. This is a poem called Parting of Ways, in which he talks about a man with links to two very different places, London and Kenya, and who is, like so many a Londoner, trying to forge these cultural links somehow. Leaving behind the family's hut where he was born and raised, and listened to his sister's chants, the village one day awoke, bestowed its pastoral pride, and bid him farewell. On his return from England, the neighbours came, flocked around him. Oddly, his first act was to read them aloud the opening lines of Paradise Lost, and followed this with a talk about Longfellow and his love of Pope. Their startled eagerness held beyond a reading from Wordsworth, and their eyes lost a little glimmer as he adjusted his voice to recapture an Oxford accent. He then unfolded an album, and the village saw, for the first time, a grey charm before them, the Thames, as it moved silently east past the Tower Bridge. The village listened patiently, trapped at the edge of precise phrasing, unique learning, and there was silence. Some people rose and collected their stools and walking sticks, parted, and moved their peasant features away like a squatter rises, recollects himself, seeing his presence out of harmony with things. There was an old baobab tree in the centre of the village. Here they went and sat, to regroup back their dignity, here where they know themselves best, in the clearness of a calm, quiet shade.